I want to thank those who participated and did the work behind the scenes work for the dinner last week for Pastor Appreciation. I know there was a lot of work, and a lot of chairs went up, a lot of tables went up, and then they all had to come back down, a lot of cooking. And Gus and Candace and I know Wade and Lena were involved. Many others were involved, but really do appreciate that. We can use, we can use your help in the fellowship ministry. In fact, we have Christmas with the church coming up. If you're looking for a place to serve, that's a good place to serve. I was looking this morning. We have 32 different ministries in this church. Now, you don't think that. And because sometimes you come up to me and say, when are we going to do something around here? No. What we do now takes 200 to 250 volunteers. And we could use 350, but that's an area of the church that can really use your help. And I hope that you see Gus. Gus is the guy with the man bun. He's the only guy here I know with the man bun. Great leader. When I was a kid, I played baseball, and I think baseball was probably my favorite sport. I played soccer just a little bit. Wasn't big enough to really play football and make a mark, but I liked baseball. But one of the things that annoyed me even when I was 8 and 9 years old with baseball were the cliches you would hear from the audience, from the people who really weren't your coach, but who thought they were, those guys up in the stands. And it didn't make much sense to me, because even as a kid, you'd get your little bat and you're going out there to get up to the plate, and somebody would yell inevitably, "Grip it and rip it." I said, "What's that supposed to mean? Do you mean hold the bat and hit it where they ain't? Because if that's what you meant, I was going to do that anyway. I would come up here and drop the bat and, you know, hit it where they were." What do you say something like "grip it and rip it"? And then, you know, you get up there and if you missed the first ball and you had one strike on you, somebody else would yell out, "Now wait on your pitch." It's like you wanted to say, "Listen, the guy on the mound hit a growth spurt this summer. He's about a foot taller than I am. I know it doesn't look like he's throwing 100 miles to you, but from my place, it looks like about 100 miles an hour. None of his pitchers are my pitches. I'm going to try to get the ball in play down the third base line and run like, you know, I'm leaving Target with a TV during a peaceful protest. The cops are on the way. I don't know." And then, you know, you get the second strike on you, and then some joker would yell out. What would they yell out? That would be one joker's return. And I on the ball, they would yell out in North Carolina, "Now you're ready." It's like, no, I was ready when I had zero strikes. Now I'm hanging by a thread and about 15 seconds from walking back to the dugout. You know, but you have those cliches. And what's true in sports is sometimes true in the church, in Christianity. And we have our cliches, and sometimes I wonder if people know what they mean, because we'll say things like, you know, when God closes a door, he opens a window. You know, and it's like, oh, what does that mean? It means the way of escape is narrowing, it sounds like to me. I mean, I don't know why that's a good thing. And then sometimes people will say, well, are you at peace with the decision? And people say that, and I'm honest when people ask me that. Are you at peace with the decision? The biblical answer is, yeah, but then Jonah was really at peace in the bottom of that boat, and Jesus wasn't all at peace in the Garden of Gethsemane, so I don't know what peace has to do with it. Because one was in the will, one was not. But you say, am I at peace? And I don't know what that always means. Or this one, you got to put it in the hands of God. Now, That sounds like a cliche, but actually, that's Bible. And I want to talk to you about that because, again, I think it gets used as a cliche, and I think people think it's a cliche, and it's one of those things that Christians say, just give it to the Lord. Let go and let God. And yet, if you look at 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 5 through 7, that's sort of what Peter's saying. He says, likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Are my kids here? Yes, all of you be submissive to one another. Well, that he could have left that out. All of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility, for God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. So he doesn't say put yourself in the hands of God, but he gets awfully close there. He says you ought to humble yourself under the mighty hand of God and cast your care on him. And you say, well, where does the care go? And I think he's talking about the mighty hand. So cast your care in the mighty hands of God and humble yourself beneath the hands of God. Jesus will say in Luke chapter 23, 46 on the cross, into your hands I commend my spirit. And so there are credentials for saying to somebody, your situation, you need to put it in the hands of God and leave it there. And yet, when you say that, there's still work to be done, because what does that mean? If I've got a situation, what does it mean to get it in the hands of God? And I want to tell you one thing that it doesn't mean, and then three things that it does mean. The first thing it doesn't mean is that you keep carrying it. You got to let it go. And I think you do that in prayer. You say, Lord, this is too big for me. This is too heavy for me. This is God-sized problem. This is something that's, if I keep carrying it, it's going to destroy me. I'm not big enough. I'm not strong enough. I'm not wise enough. Lord, take this. I'm giving it to you. And in your help, I'm not going to pick it up. I'm not going to carry this thing around with me. I'm going to try not to think about it, although that's going to be hard. But when I think about it, I'm going to try to pray about it. I'm going to try to remind you that this is your problem, and I'm not going to do anything about it unless you tell me to. I'm going to let you have it. Now, every problem isn't like that. And the Bible gives us quite a lot of things that we ought to be doing and not just giving it to the Lord. You know, there's a great passage in Exodus chapter 14 where Moses is being pursued by the Egyptian armies. They're at the Red Sea, but the Red Sea hasn't really parted yet. And Moses says, I think in verse 13, he says, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. And in verse 14, God says, no, go forward. Stop it. Run. You know, I'm not going to destroy him there. Get through the water. I'll destroy him there. And that's true of our life. It's a parable sort of sometimes where we are. We're saying, I'm going to stand still. And God's saying, no, go forward. You have a word. Move ahead. And so if you have a financial problem, I think God would already have said to you in Scripture, get a job. Get a job. Get a job. Go. Get a job. You're not working in this economy. Get a job. And you say, well, I don't have enough money. Well, quit spending yourself into oblivion. Quit doing that. You may say, well, you know, we're married and we got all these issues. Well, quit saying awful things to each other. Try to honor and love each other in your situation. I mean, the Bible gives us lots and lots of instructions. So in many ways, we might be standing there, but God is saying, go forward. But there are things that are big. There isn't a way out, per se. There isn't a way forward. And in those situations, you and I are going to have to put those things in the hands of God. One of them, what would that be? I think the big one is revenge, right? We're constantly called to forgive. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I will repay. Vengeance is hard to get. everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people love vengeance. You know, if you think about Hollywood, Hollywood makes movies, at least in theory, that appeals to audiences. And then I wonder why they make a lot of the stuff that they make, but at least in theory, that's true. But if you think about movies, what's like, you have your love stories, but then what's the other great genre of movies? Revenge movies. Basically, most of the great Westerns are revenge movies. Somebody killed his wife, somebody killed his kid, somebody raided his ranch, and now the movie's about him getting vengeance. Most of the action movies we watch now are what? Basically revenge movies. Somebody died, somebody got thieved, something happened, and the rest of the movie is the guy taking vengeance on the individual. I mean, we like revenge. We think about it. I think most of us would probably be embarrassed to say that we have actually thought what it might be like to go into our high school in the 20th reunion and just stick it to everybody. We're mean to us. And we stick it, maybe we are successful, maybe we know that who we're dating or married to is bound to be the best looking person in the room. Somehow, we're going to stick it to those people who look down on us. You know, we don't talk about that because that sounds stupid, and it is stupid. But you know what? We think about it more than we ought to. And so there is this sense of wanting revenge, wanting to set the record straight. But again, that's hard to do in life. Hard to do. What are you going to do? End up in jail? What are you going to do? You're gonna try to get them back, and they don't even know they did anything wrong to you. So vengeance is one of the things that you almost. And the Bible says vengeance is His, so not almost, but you always have to give that to the Lord. Resolving most conflict is really something you have to give the Lord. Because most conflict, to really resolve it, now you can work out an orchestrated peace, but to really resolve conflict, hearts have to change. And I can't change your heart, and you can't change my heart. God changes hearts. That's why if you're a kid and, you know, your parents are thinking about getting a divorce, and one of the things that might cross your mind is, you know, what can I do to bring my family back together? And the answer is nothing. Nothing. Hearts have to change. And marriage is hard. I was talking to a marriage counselor a while back, and they said, you know, marriage counseling, and my dad would say this, he did a lot of marriage counseling. Marriage counseling tends to be really unsuccessful. And the reason marriage counseling tends to be very unsuccessful is because most people come 6 months or a year too late. They came after the affair. They came after they said those terrible things. They came after, you know, she said, I just, you know, married you because I was lonely and I thought you had a lot of money or something. They came after the words are said. You can't get it back in the bag, you know. Come too late. And so, you know, even the best marriage counselors don't bat 50%. But the issue is that to really put it back together, to get, I mean, you can take a marriage and you can put two people in the same house with, an orchestrated, a negotiated peace. But to really have a marriage after it's broken, man, God's got to change hearts. That's a God-sized problem. Got to have to put that in the hands of God. There are things that you have to put in the hands of God. A lot of the physical things we deal with, they got to go in the hands of God. I mean, our medical profession, they're wonderful. But there's still so much that they can't help you with. They can't. A lot of the things we face, we have to put in the hands of God. That's what Jesus is saying on the cross, into your hands I commend my spirit. In other words, Jesus knows he's going to die. And he says, you know what? In this situation, I'm just giving myself. I'm in the hands of the Lord. Whether I live or die, I'll be, you know, this is in God's power to control. And that's all that I can do in that situation. My kids have been watching, or the two older ones have been watching Pirates of the Caribbean. I haven't told them all about, you know, the Johnny and Amber thing yet, but they're just enjoying enjoying Pirates of the Caribbean. But there's this scene in the second one that we watched this week where, you know, the Kraken is coming up around the boat, and it's this huge sea monster, and Jack's alone on the boat, and you know, the mouth of the Kraken opens, and all he can do is just sort of point his sword at it. But you can see in his eyes, it's like, I'm resolved. It's like, God's got to deliver me from this one. I'm dead meat. And there are times in life when you're there, you have to just say, nothing I can do with it. I can't change the hearts of the people involved. I can't rip the cancer out of my body. I can't even the score. I can't go back and change what has happened. All I can do is say, Lord, it's too big for me. It's too big for me. It's a God-sized problem. I just don't need it in my weak human hands. I've got to put it in some mighty hands. The only mighty hands I know. Now, you have to take your hands off of it in many ways. But then there's three things you can do, though. It's just not about going home and doing nothing. But first of all, then you and I, after we say that, after we say, Lord, this is in your hands, we need to be patient, actively patient. And with God, you're going to have to be patient. It took how many years for Abraham and Sarah to have that child? At least 25. How long did it take Joseph to go from prison to the throne? A long time. How long did it take David to go from killing Goliath to the throne? It took a long time. They were in Egyptian bondage for, what, 400 years. It takes God a long time to get there sometimes. Now, one day is as 1,000 years with God, so it's not long with him. But you and I are going to have to be patient if we want God to move. Once we give it to the Lord, we're going to have to be willing to hold on and to say, Lord, I'm not going to move until you want me to move. If it takes some time, I'm not going to charge ahead and try to get it out of your hands. This is a situation I know I can't fix. The only way it's going to be fixed is if you do it. If I take it out of your hands, I'll be back in the same place I am now. I still won't be able to fix it. So I'm leaving it to you. I'm going to be patient with what you're trying to do. And then secondly, you have to be obedient. I'm patient, but while God is working, I'm going to be obedient to what he wants me to do. Now, the reason I say that is this. When it seems like God is taking a long time, we have trouble staying obedient. We do. When God seems to be taking his time, you know what? We are likely to say, or tempted to say, I should say, what good does it do to pray? What good does it do to go to church? What good does it do to worship? What good does it do to do what is right when nothing seems to be happening good? I had a friend who a lot of people didn't understand, but he was well into his 40s, and I think he probably wanted to be married, but that hadn't happened, and he was very disappointed with where he was in life, and a lot of things had not gone right for him, and I loved him. I still love him, and other people used to beat him up and say terrible things about him, but my heart was always very warm towards him because I've tried to put myself in his shoes. And with all the disappointment that he was feeling in life, and we'd grown up together, but he was a little older than me, he would go home to that house of his, this little house, and he had nothing to do all afternoon. And so he naturally struggled with issues related to alcohol and smoking and pornography, but he would go home and temptation was all around him and disappointment was in his heart. And that can be an issue for you and I. When we're waiting and we want the ship to come in and we wanted to be married when we're 25 and we're 35, or we wanted to be at the top of the ladder when we're 35 and we're 45, and it doesn't seem like anything much is happening in our life, we can very easily say, what good is it? What good is it to pray? What good is it to remain faithful? What good is it to hold the line and to be what I should be when it doesn't seem to be making a difference? But if you're going to put it in the hands of God, you got to be faithful. You got to be obedient. You got to be patient. That's sort of what it means to be a waitress, right? I mean, it's interesting terminology. When we say that somebody is a waitress or a waiter, we say, what are they doing? Well, they're waiting. But what are they doing as they wait? Well, they're working. They're being obedient. Be a waitress as you're waiting. That's the point. You think about soldiers. I think I was talking to one of you. I might have been Billy Fox. Her son is deployed. Or he's at a base, but there's not much happening. I think it was Billy, somebody. It could have been someone else. And so what does he do? He does sentry duty, you know. He stands out there, he checks in people getting onto the base and not. And that's probably not what he went into the military to do. He probably thought his life would be a lot more exciting going into the military than just standing out there checking people's ID, getting on the base. That's basically what he's going to do. But you can imagine at one point, you know, maybe you're thinking, you know, I got in here for action. I got in here to see something done. I got in here to make a difference. Forget about it. I'm leaving. You throw your gun in the back of the car and you drive away and you go AWOL. It's like, this is it. I hear you shouldn't do that, though. I hear bad things will happen to you if you do that. What do you do? You gotta stay where you put. You gotta be obedient. You gotta wait for the action to come. But you can't just quit like that. You got to be obedient to the powers that be. And you have to do that because, see, listen, one of the things that is happening as we're waiting, we've put it in the hands of God and now we gotta be patient. One of the things that is happening, the Bible will say repeatedly, is that now God is doing a work inside of us. And in this time of waiting, he's building our character. He's building our patience. He's building our resolve. But when you do most of your praying before he answers, not after, right? So now you're praying. Now you're building. You know, if God gave it to you, you'd probably be like you are now. You don't need anything, so it's really hard to pray. But that waiting period, he's building something in you. He's doing surgery on you. He's taking things out of your life that needed to be cleansed anyway. There's a lot going on while you're waiting. God is doing a work. And what do you know if you're on the surgeon's table? Again, you got to be still. You got to wait. You got to be obedient. Because nothing good is going to happen to you if you're on the surgeon's table and you're moving around. Nothing good's going to happen. I came to Greenville. I wasn't here very long when I had an ingrown toenail. And I had never had that before. My mom had several. And she said, oh, it's a piece of cake. You go down and, what is it, podiatrist? You find your podiatrist. They got some numbing lotion now. They put the lotion on you. They'll cut it out. It's a piece of cake. Easiest thing in the world. I think, well, I'll go down to the podiatrist. I found one in town. I didn't know anybody. I found one, and I went down, and he's working. He's getting the needle ready. I said, hey, what about the lotion? I heard there's lotion, man. And he looked at me and said, I haven't heard anything about lotion. He said, no, we got to put 6 shots in that toe all the way around, and if that doesn't work, we have to put some more in. I don't like the needles, man. That's not good. Like that. A lot of pressure going on in the big toe. And I thought about it. I can work this out. I got a knife. I'll work on this thing. But he gave me 6 shots. It's horrible. Went away for 15 minutes. I'm sitting there sweating profusely. He comes in. He says, well, tell me if you feel anything. Starts cutting his man. He's like, oh, I feel it. Like, oh, we got to give you 6 more. And so 12 shots in my little toe. And by the 10th shot, nurses are in, feeding me crackers, waving their little, I pass out. But nothing's good's going to happen if you keep moving. You got to stick that toe out there and hold on. Nothing's good's going to happen if you give it to the Lord and you keep moving around. If you can't be obedient, don't give it to the Lord. You've got to give it to the Lord and then say, Lord, I'm going to be patient. I'm going to wait on you. Now it's in your hands. I'm waiting on you and I'm going to walk the guard. I'm going to be in a position. Whatever you want to do in my life, I know you're probably going to be working in my life. And so I'm going to hold still. I'm going to hold the line. And then third, you got to be patient. You got to be obedient. And then you got to be hopeful. You got to be hopeful. Look at Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 1. Habakkuk is in a place where the Babylonians are about to invade and it's about to get rough in this country. And he sees what's happening. And so he's very concerned and he asks God to do something. And God doesn't give Habakkuk the answer that he wants. God says, I don't think I'm going to stop the judgment from coming now. So this is what Habakkuk says. He says, I will stand my watch and sit myself on the rampart and watch to see what he will say to me and what I will answer when I am corrected. Habakkuk says, you know, there's trouble ahead. There's nothing I can do about it. I can't fix this issue, but I'm going to go up on the ramparts. I'm going to go up on the wall of the city, and I'm going to go as high as I can in one of the towers, and I'm going to sit there. And I'm going to look out over the horizon because I know the Babylonians are coming from the north. But I'm going to look because there might be an army of salvation coming from the other direction. I'm going to sit on this wall and I'm going to watch and I'm going to look out on the horizon hoping that salvation comes over those hills for us. And Habakkuk says, whatever then has happened, I'm still going to be hopeful. And that's what you and I have to be. If it's in the hands of God, you and I ought to be hopeful. If we've given it to the Lord, those are mighty hands. Those are big hands. There's a lot of wisdom in those hands. There's a lot of power in those hands. Giving it to the Lord isn't the same thing as giving up. Giving it to the Lord isn't the same thing as saying, well, there's nothing that can be done. No, giving it to the Lord says it's bigger than me, but it's not too big for him. So I got to be patient. I got to be obedient. But because it's in the hands of the Lord, I'm going to be hopeful. That's what David says, you know, in 27:14, I think, where he says, I'll trust in the Lord. From whence does my strength come from? I think that's, if it's not 27:14, it's somewhere in there. And he says, I'm going to trust in the hand of God. It's essentially what Isaiah is saying when he says those who wait upon the Lord will renew their strength. What is he saying? He's saying, if I give it to the Lord and I wait on the Lord and I'm patient and I'm obedient and I ought to keep doing what I know I ought to be doing, so I'm going to keep doing that, I have every reason to be hopeful. I want to say that to someone here today. I'm talking more than one person. I don't know who I'm talking to. But I know life is filled with God-sized problems. I know life is filled with issues that we can't fix in our lives. Listen, many of you here have struggled with addictions in your life. And what you know is that the desire can't be taken from you. It can be, but you can't expel it. Now, God gives you power to live victorious. And oftentimes that's victory day by day. In the fight day by day. But the desire itself, you always have victory over the desire, but you can't always expel the desire. That's a God-sized problem. You can't change the hearts of people that don't like you and don't love you. That's going to have to be a God-sized problem. Now, you can be nice, you can be friendly, you can help, but ultimately, you can't change their heart from a heart that dislikes you to the heart that likes you. And you can't even score. There's a lot you can't do. But if it's in the hands of God, you can be hopeful. But you got to leave it there. It's not in the hands of God if it's still in your hands. It's not in the hands of God, really, if you're being disobedient and you're running around trying to fix life and solve it yourself. It's really not in the hands of God. And listen, If it's in the hands of God, you ought to be the most hopeful person in the world. There was a kid. You stand with me. Stand with me. I've got a back problem going on. A lot of lower pain in my back. Is that part of getting old? I don't know if my wife did this something to me in the night. It could be. There was a kid many years ago. He was a little boy, and he walked into a general store. And in the general store, there was a bucket of candy. And this little kid had dirt on his face, and his hair was all messed up, and had dirt on his clothes. Didn't have any shoes on. And so he walks up to this bucket. And in my mind, he's about the size of my Samuel, about, I guess, I don't know how old, in my mind, he's 4 or 5 years old. And he's just looking at this bucket of candy. And the owner goes over to this little boy and says, "Kid, just get you a couple handfuls of candy there, and just reach in there, just get you a couple handfuls, put it in your pocket." And the kid just looks at him and stares at him. And the owner said, "No, the kid, it's not going to cost you anything. It's free. Put your hands in there, get you a couple handfuls of candy, put it in your pocket, go home. It's free. It's my gift." Yeah. The kid just stands there and stares at him. The owner goes over and puts his hands in there and gets a couple handfuls of candy. It says, "Kid, pull your shirt out. Get it up there." And you know how you carry stuff in your shirt. And he puts all that candy in the kid's shirt. Kid smiles and says thank you and turns to leave. And the owner said, "Kid, I told you twice to get some candy. Why didn't you do it when I told you twice?" The kid turned around with a big smile and said, "Because your hands are bigger than mine." Now, God's hands are bigger than yours. And they're just not big. They're mighty hands. They can hold more than your hands can hold. Hatred, unforgiveness will destroy you. Trying to fix and make people love you that don't love you will destroy you. Worrying to death about problems that you can't change will destroy you. But God's got some really big hands. And what's small for you and what's overwhelming for you and I, it's a small thing for Him. These are mighty, mighty hands. I love Exodus 3:14, where Moses is thinking about going, or actually he really doesn't have a choice, but he's trying to argue with God to not send them to Egypt. And God says, I think in verse 14 there, He says, "Listen, Moses, I know it's going to take some mighty hands. I know I'm going to be the one who has to do it." Praise the Lord, He does have some mighty hands. He's got hands of protection. He's got hands of provision. He's got hands of power. Somebody here needs to take your feeble hands. You're weighed down. Your shoulders are sinking because you're carrying something that you weren't meant to carry. And you need to come to Jesus Christ today and say, "Lord, I've tried. This is what I got. I can't fix it. I know I can't fix it. It's too big for me. As best as I know how, I'm casting it into your hands. I'm casting it to you. I'm giving it to you. I'm taking my hands off of it. I'm going to be patient if you'll help me. Help me. I'm going to be obedient if you'll help me. I'm going to be hopeful. Because I'm not giving up, but I'm putting it in the hands that move the world. I'm going to leave them there." Father, I pray.